So for those of you who don't know me, my name's Jennifer Lang. I'm your chair for this session. I'm at the Commonwealth Bank. And this session, just have a read, that just make sure you're in the right place. Hedging, investment guarantees, international best practice. We've got three speakers today, all from Milliman. Wade Madison, who heads Milliman's Sydney office, senior consultant and leader of Milliman's Australian financial risk management practice. Joined the firm in 2004 and responsible for product development and risk management for clients throughout the Asia-Pacific region. Rajiv Dutt. Rajiv is a senior consultant in the Chicago office of Milliman, worked on various consulting projects to implement financial risk management programs. And Deep Patel, also in the Chicago office, a senior consultant with the financial risk management practice in their Chicago office, with extensive experience in product design and development of equity-based guarantee products. They've got a presentation which will probably go for about half an hour, and then we'll have time for questions and comments after that. The usual rules apply, which I'll remind you of when we get to that point. Come to the microphone, say your name before the comments. And just before we start, I thought I'd implement my own mobile phone rule, that if your mobile phone does go off, a $50 donation to the charity of the conference will apply. So you can choose whether to leave it on and take the risk, because after all, it's a good cause, or turn it off and no donation. So with that, over to you, Wade.
Thanks, Jennifer. It's obviously fascinating to look at the program for this conference and compare it to, I guess, 2 years ago when I first spoke on the subject of guarantees. And I think there are probably somewhere around about three papers or presentations on the topic. And since then, it's really boomed, and it's becoming a much more prevalent subject, particularly as the issues around retirement and retirement security become, come to the fore. Rather than sort of recap rehash a lot of the old material, it's fairly obvious a lot of the development in this market is pretty well documented. Looking at overseas products, particularly the US, where various guarantees around retirement savings in the variable annuity space have taken off over the last number of years, and that market's now a very sizable one. Probably more interesting and relevant is the Japanese market, which started much later. It's probably 6 or 7 years ago, off the back of a number of multinationals that took the concept over there. And looking at the sheer growth of that market, where it's now in excess of $100 billion, kind of gives a blueprint for the type of growth in various products and the attractiveness to consumers. Clearly, the Australian development is starting, and it's starting relatively slowly. AXA have launched their product, their GMAB version. It's just been launched into the retail market, ordinary money. The Australian market, there's also a few other interesting opportunities. You see protection in different fields as well. So, there's a lot of protected loans in margin lending business, and there's a question of whether, some of the similar concepts that people use in risk managing those types of products can easily be adopted to try and innovate some of the product concepts there as well. Clearly the guarantees represent various options, and what's made it possible is the growth and sophistication of risk management, and in particular, hedging options. Looking at an Australian market which has only a small number of probably multinationals, something else that I think is going to foster the growth in the products here is just the wealth of options around risk transfer, and in particular, you see, I guess I was at the conference in Hong Kong on equity-based guarantees, and there are a huge number of reinsurers and investment banks and all sorts of parties there. And that's also helped in the US as well, where I guess what initially started the trend towards risk management was simply that the reinsurance market dried up very quickly when the tech wreck occurred over there, because a lot of the reinsurers at that point weren't running risk management programs and obviously suffered as markets went through a downturn. Now that they've become more comfortable with the concepts and developed their own risk management programs, they've started to come back into the market again and provide capacity in that way. Now, this is a little bit of a misnomer in the heading, I guess. Obviously, I'm talking really about market risk there. A lot of these products contain a lot more than that, various risks around demographic behaviour, withdrawals and so on and so forth. And I'm actually talking about this a little bit more this afternoon. But there's a range of options. And I guess the thing to really be aware of is at the end of the day, when we're talking about risk management, it can be, you know, it can be promoted in a number of different ways, whether it's a structured solution or a static hedge or semi-static, or it's a reinsurance risk transfer. But at the end of the day, when it comes down to the market risk component, it winds up on the market in some way. And to the extent that it doesn't, then there's a party in the middle that's taking a bet on a particular position. And the interesting thing is technology itself has evolved to the point where it's really changing the way that, you know, people can view structured products. So your traditional investment bank-led structured product, which is very closed-ended in tranches and that type of thing, by introducing not simplifying, but cutting through the complication and opaqueness of how these things are risk managed, really opens the door to new and innovative ways of designing these types of products. I guess what I see is one of the key challenges in the market as it goes forward is really sifting through the range of options for some of the local players to figure out, you know, to ensure that they're getting efficient terms in terms of pricing, risk transfer, and managing things like counterparty risk. But at that point, I'll hand over to Dee.
Thanks, Wade. I'm going to start by just giving you a high-level overview of what we're going to cover today with this hedging objectives checklist. First one is having your hedging program clearly defined and documented. With a lot of insurance companies, just dealing with derivatives are fairly new, and it gets a lot of exposure. It gets a lot of exposure from regulators, auditors. So it's really important to have all the processes in place. Obviously, auditors are looking into this in a lot of detail. Another important thing is the accounting treatment. Now, it sounds like in Australia, the accounting treatment for these types of investment guarantees are fairly clear. I work in the U.S. where it varies quite a bit. On a U.S. GAAP basis, depending on the product, the accounting treatment is different. If it's on a statutory basis, the accounting treatment is very different. And that all comes into play as you're deciding on your risk management strategy. Another important question is just balancing all the interests. When you're looking at managing your risk, just defining what risk that is. Is it economic risk, accounting risk? Are you trying to just manage your capital position? And we'll get into more detail on that in the next slide. And then if your choice of hedging strategy is just dynamic hedging, just identifying the hedging instruments you're using, making sure that there's enough liquidity in the market to handle the expected sales level, which exposures to hedge, and things like rebalance frequency and rebalance tolerances. And then, of course, you're just overall as a company, your capital market view, whether in pricing and in hedging, you look at this risk on a real-world basis where you have, like, an equity risk premium or on a risk-neutral basis. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later as well. And then finally, just doing financial projections of the hedge program, making sure that senior management understands the risks, understands the financial impacts. So the first thing that I'm going to talk about are just the overall hedging objectives in terms of balancing what risks you want to or what your main criteria is. And a lot of companies we found often just get straight into the hedging strategy without really thinking about what they're trying to achieve, and that often causes a lot of issues later on. The three main ones are just managing your economic risk. Basically, trying to have a strategy that will cover you over the life of the product. This type of definition is usually like a fair value reserve. There's different ways to define fair value, and we'll get into that in a bit. Then there's accounting risk. Seems like from talking to Wade that the good thing in Australia is a lot of these the accounting risk, the economic risk are aligned. That's not the case in the U.S. and causes for a lot more decisions. But I think that's a good step here. And same with capital reduction. The Australian regulation both accounting and capital are a function of a fair value shock. So you'll see that whatever hedges you have will move in a manner similar to the way that both your capital and your accounting reserves move. So once you've decided on your hedging objectives, the next question is really what strategy you want to use to manage that risk. And obviously, going naked is the first one. You just collect your fees, and hopefully that'll pay for claims, and you hold enough capital. It's not advised to do that for many reasons, because most of the risks aren't. When you have capital market risk, it's different than a lot of the other risks insurance companies face. They're systematic. When the market goes down for all policies. Also, when you look at return on capital, most capital measures these days provide hedge credit. So if you actually looked at your return on capital, you'd often find that hedging the risk allows you to hold less capital for this product and sell more of it. And then there's static hedging. This is where you work with an investment bank to structure a derivative that matches fairly closely to the payoff of the liability. One important note there is that they're not with these static hedges. They're not taking on any capital market risk. Oh, sorry, they are taking capital market risk, not any actuarial risk. So we've worked with companies that have purchased these static hedges, and you basically tell the bank what your mortality assumption, lapse assumption is, and if there's any deviation. You'll have to bear that mismatch, and you have several alternatives. You can either go back to the bank and true it up. Of course, with these structured hedges, the transaction costs are quite high, and so you might find that the cost of doing this is quite expensive. Another approach, which we've done for some of our clients, is just providing a dynamic overlay. So you have a dynamic hedging program to kind of hedge the residual risk. Semi-static hedging is another approach where you'd buy and hold a set of options, vanilla instruments, and rebalance every quarter, every year. We haven't found that to be that popular. And then dynamic hedging, where you're basically dynamically replicating this risk on an ongoing basis. You set up programs to monitor the market, monitor the risk on a daily basis, and use vanilla instruments, fairly liquid instruments to hedge this risk away. And in the U.S., that's by far the most popular approach. And then finally, reinsurance. As Wade was saying earlier, for a while their reinsurance capacity had gone away, and in the U.S. it's coming back, and you should see most of these reinsurers are global, and they're entering markets in Japan and likely in Australia at some point. In terms of best practices, and regardless of the hedging objective or the hedging strategy, it's pretty much the case that you'd want to, when you're looking at this risk, look at it on a market consistent basis. By doing like a risk-neutral valuation, where you're creating scenarios that could match the prices of many different types of instruments, and then use those to value the investment guarantee. Now, there's a lot of variation in terms of what you use. Like, there's so many instruments out there. Most of these guarantees are based off of equity risk, so you, of course, want to make sure that you can reproduce the prices of equity options. Some of the guarantees have interest rate risk, not all of them, and if it does, then you'd want to make sure that you can reproduce swaption prices. And then a few have currency exposure as well, so you'd want to be able to reproduce currency options. Now, it's important to know that you need to look at the risks that you have, and really it's not always better to have models that reproduce all these instruments if it doesn't really pertain to the product that you're selling, because it adds a lot of complexity, makes things harder to understand. So that's something to note. The other reason why it's important to stick with market consistent valuation is, regardless of the strategy you're taking, if you're buying static hedges or reinsuring, both banks look at this risk in a market consistent way, and so do most reinsurance companies. So you're gonna, whichever way you go, you're gonna kind of face this. And even say if you went with going naked, at some point you may want to start hedging. So kind of want to embed in your pricing the cost of hedging right away. Whether you decide to take that risk on yourself, you still want to be compensated for it in your pricing. Now, another important consideration is just with market consistency. I said earlier that there's so many levels of market consistency, so many different instruments out there. It's important to look at the inputs that you're using. For example, a lot of the guarantees that are out there, they go out for 15 years, 20 years. There isn't an options market that goes out that far. At least in the S&P 500 contracts, go out to about 5 years. Occasionally, you'll see options out for 10 years, but it's very illiquid. And you have to decide whether you want to use market-implied vols for options that far out in your valuation. When these products are illiquid, often the implied vols are moving around because of supply and demand. Hedge fund happen to want to sell some options, or an insurance company happen to want to buy a lot of options, and that drives the price more than just the market's view of future realized volatility. Finally, in terms of the whole process of setting up your hedge program, deciding on your strategy, an important thing is to really stress test the strategy. We often perform financial projections where we're simulating the hedge program through different stressed historical periods as well as stochastic periods. And we find it very, very important because it illustrates that hedging is not risk-free. There are going to be scenarios where dynamic hedging doesn't work well. It's important to identify what those are and for senior management to know that that even though you're hedging, there's still risk remaining. As well as when you're looking at accounting, when we do these simulations, senior management might decide that they want to hedge their economic risk, and that's fine. And then when you're doing projections of their income volatility, they might see a lot more income volatility than they're comfortable with, and it might change their minds. They might realize that, yes, we actually do need to look at accounting. I guess that's it on the first part, which is just developing your strategy, deciding on your objectives. I'll pass it on to Rajiv to talk more about systems and operations.
Thanks, Steve. So we're trying to finish here at 10:30 to allow for sufficient Q&A. So I've got 8 slides. That's a minute apiece. As Deep talked about, primarily the financial implications of a hedge program, I'm going to focus more on the operational side. So systems requirements. Three things to consider here, seriatim versus compressed data file. So Wade, is seriatim the term? Yeah, seriatim versus a model office or compressed. Time step of the model and a number of scenarios. So you've got to get a balance across this in order to fit onto your existing computing platform. What we find in a lot of our installations, so companies will have several hundred computers dedicated to this process. They'll split the grid across two geographical locations for disaster recovery purposes and balance of load. The idea here, though, is the most complicated model in the world is of no value if you can't do a nightly valuation of the liabilities. So on a nightly basis, you're valuing your liabilities. You're doing your shocks to the system to come up with your trading grids, or the Greeks. And then during the day, you're rebalancing your asset position. So you need a model and a dedicated team with your existing IT resources, constraints of the IT environment, to run your system properly. A little bit on the trading side. So capital markets and the trading group, obviously you need to have the checks and balances in place such that you can avoid a Nick Leeson type activity. Your capital markets guys are managing, in our shop, we're managing multiple books, but separately, the actual execution of trade, what the market looked like before the trade, during the trade, and after the trade in order to measure the efficiency of the execution, all of that has to be captured. Client companies, they really want to see the value add of their derivatives trading desk or their outsource shop, what have you. These processes have to be documented. From a Sarbanes-Oxley point of view, the black box hedging technique has disappeared. It has to be clear. Deep talked about a clearly defined hedge strategy. So clearly defined is just that. That can be replicated via standard computer software such as Excel, can be all the parameters for the various nightly runs are captured and reproducible. One thing we do is for the individual policies, the policy number is the random seed for the scenario. So that way, each policy is getting its own set of scenario distribution, but it's reproducible downstream based on valuation date and policy number. Disaster recovery. It's interesting. I saw a show this morning. It was talking about all the people have left the planet, something like that. Disaster recovery, when we talk to a lot of senior folks on hedging programs, they define the hedge program to be able to run without human intervention for a period of time. I presented about 2 years ago with an individual who said his company's objective is 90 days. Well, based on the show today, in 2 days, when there were no humans on the earth, the power system would shut down. So for the remaining 88 days, I'm not sure what's going to happen. But the point here is, without human intervention in a reproducible form that's auditable and transparent, your system must continue to be able to operate. Independent audits. So obviously, internal and external audits, audit groups will give their opinion on the hedge capability, and so the system itself should be able to, on the fly, on the production fly, produce the audit cells that are required for the various audit tests. This slide here talks about basically the resource requirement for a hedge program. It's capital markets people, professional traders, so Wall Street type people, actuarial modelers, student resources, the technology experts to make this work on a distributed grid environment, and then the actual quantitative code developers. Our shop has 70 people, of which actuaries now are the minority. I mean, this stuff is not just in the realm of the actuaries. It's beyond that. It's multi-science discipline. So getting the right people together in the insurance companies to produce this type of hedge, the proper hedge effectiveness, that you really have to go multidiscipline. The requirements. So here, the number of people necessary. I mean, we've seen shops that have, one of my clients has 130 people committed to this exercise. We have other shops that might have 5 people. Obviously, that's dictated by the size of the block, the scope of the hedging program, and whether it's in, 100% internal or external. Talking about reinsurance or external or outsourcing, the things to consider are, first, whether the expertise are there, whether your 5 or 130 people have the expertise necessary, and that's complete capital markets data, modeling initiatives, and so forth. And are they dedicated to this task? This is not a, we'll do it on Friday afternoons on casual Fridays. This is a full-time job for the folks. So the idea here is it's dedicated resource and dedicated research to keep up to speed on capital markets activities. The technology, of course. So, I mean, infrastructure, I talk about a block, let's say 100 computers, we say. Well, 100 computers, unfortunately, it's not, $1,000 a computer. These are expensive systems to maintain and do backups forth and have parallel and distributed computing. So oftentimes, if you don't want to do that front-end investment over, cash outlay for the IT structure, outsourcing is a worthwhile option. Speed to market. To develop these things, and our practice has been up and running about 9 years. This is not something, when we work with client companies, it may take 1 to 2 years to get their systems up and running, or on an outsource basis, they're up and running in 3 to 6 months. So these are the types of things that need to be considered. I'm down to a few minutes left and too many slides, so let's move on. Performance attribution. So on the operational side, so whereas Dee talked about defining the hedge strategy and the universe of derivative instruments to manage that block, the actual effectiveness of that strategy needs to be measured on some periodic basis, with weekly, monthly, what have you. So the idea is to break your valuations into independent steps, where you can judge the effectiveness of the various categories. Here I've listed the hedged indices, the unhedged indices, interest rates, volatilities, lapses, withdrawals, new business, basis mismatch, transfer. The idea is you redo your valuation by turning one of these features on at a time, and you compare assets and liabilities and see where the mismatch is. Ultimately, this little grid that I've got here, this shows for this sample block, this illustrative block, based on the movements, the changes in the, I'm doing just market movements here on the left-hand side, your liability moves in accordance in those independent steps, and then accordingly the hedge assets are moving based on the various instruments. They're moving hopefully in the opposite direction, and ultimately you're getting your net P&L impact. So I mean, the concept here is hedge effectiveness, and whether your strategy needs to be revised or if in fact it's working appropriately. Other measurements. So I talked about execution of trade, so the efficiency of that execution. The actual cost, I have one client company that talks about 1 basis point of account value. That's what it costs them to hedge their book of business. Various internal companies will have their own, and when I said that, that's the expense side, not the hedge cost itself, but the expense side. Various companies will have their own measurements with respect to whether they're getting the bang for the buck for their operation. I'll move on here to kind of an expanded checklist here. Deep talked about hedge objectives. I'll talk a little bit here about the operations side, anything that I've missed. So I've talked about the dedicated resource, capital planning. So when you are tracking on a quarterly or monthly basis the hedge effectiveness, then obviously you have to see the reserving capital and accounting implications of that strategy. And Deep talked about the balance of pulling the right triggers such that all of those fronts are satisfied. New business planning, so pre-hedging for expected block sales over time. Let's see, we talked about computing grid. Management approval. Let's do a little bit about that. So this is great. So the CEO of the company attends a session like this and says, you know, that hedging, that sounds really good. We should do some of that. But it's really defining the steps of what's necessary. What's the objective? What will the overall outlay be? What will the exposure to the company's capital be? And at the end, presenting that to management and saying, all right, this is the defined strategy. This is what should be entered into the investment guideline, and accordingly, this is the criteria that will be measured whether it's being effective or not. So management approval, a big item there. I've got two last slides here on international implications. Wade talked about a Japanese market. So what we see, the example I've got here is currency risk. So you've got Japanese guarantees in U.S.-denominated funds. So accordingly, you'll have U.S. indices and the FX exposure. So there's a cross-Greek concept or a multiplicative risk that has to be incorporated. So the interesting thing here is the order of your attributions may affect the overall. So you've really got to be careful of how you kind of lay out your attribution report. Interest rate modeling here, so your interest rate generator for, let's say, the Japanese environment, that has to replicate a low interest rate environment but also allow for possible future interest rate scenarios where it may be higher. So the generator itself needs to tie back to historical but potentially incorporate anything that may be anticipated for the future. Other international implications we see on the regulatory side. So an example would be Korea. Korea allows the hedging credit so long as the hedging is done locally. And so cross-border reinsurance is not where they're getting the credit. They're getting the credit if it's – and this is something recent, I think just February of this year. We see in Japan, on the flip side, hedge credit not allowed. Reinsurance is the preferred solution. So we see a lot of the Japanese banks setting up subsidiaries, offshore subsidiaries, allowing for the hedging to take place offshore but getting the reinsurance credit as compared to the hedge credit. Another thing, time zone and timing considerations. So, I mean, you're trading. There has to be a point in the day where you define, you know what, all markets are closed and now we're doing our valuation. So your nightly valuation is based on a fixed period, a fixed close date, even if, you know, markets are open and what have you, because there's no point where if you're truly a multi-international company that markets would be closed at one point in time. We've got one slide for survey results. Wade, I'll leave that to you.
I think one of the questions you repeatedly get asked, particularly in the last 5 or 6 months, is this all sounds well and good, but how have companies actually gone given the recent market volatility? And we've literally just published and compiled a survey about 16 companies that were running this type of business. And I guess the key message there, first and foremost, they were all running hedging programs, so they were relatively insulated to some extent by the fact that they were doing that. There are a lot of organisations out there that either weren't running fully effective hedging programs or had various naked positions for some reasons, and they would have felt the pain a bit more. By and large, the key message that came out of it is that companies obviously lost some money, but the key word on that slide is expected or unexpected. And what Deep talked about a bit earlier was, as part of the process of going through and stress testing these types of programs, they do a significant amount of work looking at various extreme scenarios, market crises, and to test how that's going to impact on the hedging program once it's up and running, so that when they do have these types of events and they see the results come through, they can at least back it out to the risk that they'd quantified and say, well, that's actually expected. There's a wealth of additional information on there, and it's publicly available, so feel free to digest it at your leisure.
Okay, well, that's the end of the presentation. Thanks very much to Wade, Deep and Rajiv. And now I open it up for questions and comments. So if you want to make a question ask a question or make a comment, come up to the microphone just there. Remember to say your name at the beginning and I'll throw it over to the floor. Or I'll just start with one and see if that warms the crowd up. I was quite interested in your comments on actuarial risks versus market risks. And I wondered whether there was anything in particular that about the different hedging strategies you talked about where some were better or worse than others in terms of managing to combine or separate the kind of actuarial and market risks, because ultimately for the company they're all risks and you want to be able to manage them as best you can. So I don't know if you've got any comments on that. I think that's on.
Sure. Yeah, the only solution that covers both capital market and actuarial risk is reinsurance. I mean, the other approach is static hedging. Static hedging will cover the capital market risk, as does dynamic hedging. The differences in terms of covering capital market risk between those two approaches is, like, one of the weaknesses of dynamic hedging is when you have large instantaneous moves in equity markets, interest rates, all happening at the same time, you'll see slippage in your dynamic hedging program. Most static structures will cover you in that case. And in terms of actuarial, with static hedges, clearly as time goes on and your assumptions are different than your experience, you'll see that there's a mismatch between your liability and the static hedges. One of the advantages there with dynamic hedging is that you're constantly updating your in-force, so on like a weekly basis or a monthly basis, you're at least truing up your liability model to the most current experience.
I'd just add to that as well. Like, one of the key things from an actuarial risk and behavioural is, you know, the more flexibility you introduce into these products, the more, you know, variability you would have around that. So, you know, in an Australian environment, you've got, you know, say contributions where people might want to go from say a single premium style product to one where they can add money in at later points in time. And if you leave that unchecked, then the potential is you sell a product that you think's a 7-year guarantee. People put small amounts in, and then when 1 year remaining, they put a big dump in. So, you know, it's the way you manage that is to have some form of product restriction or just understand what you're exposed to in those types of designs.
Okay. Mike?
Wade, I'm just interested in the comment here that half recorded no unexpected profit or loss. So presumably that means half had some unexpected profits or losses. So could you give us a sense of what those issues were?
Yeah, there was the numbers were a little bit better than that. That's probably a bit of a rounding error, but the exact numbers are in the report. The losses generally tend to come in around about sort of the bulk of the observations were around about 10 basis points or slightly higher. There were one or two that had higher numbers than that, and some of the reasons they sort of stated were there were operational issues. So they're either, you know, operational issues that they had in-house, teams where the markets move very quickly and you know, they maybe weren't able to rebalance as fast as they thought they needed to. And secondly, you know, whether they maybe relied, extensively on various investment bank structures and the liquidity there dried up very quickly, or, you know, the implied volatilities on some of those types of products increased dramatically overnight and they hadn't really factored that in. By and large, the sort of the dynamic approaches which team tended to sort of steer away from some of those more structured solutions tended to fare better.
Mike? Sorry to make you run around, Mike.
Mike Barker. Thanks for the presentation. Certainly a lot of detail. Things have come a long way since I last heard about it. My question is, one thing surprised me. I used to run dynamic hedging programs 15 years ago, and that was admittedly for pension funds rather than insurance companies. But we were doing it in real time. I'm surprised you're still doing things on daily cycles. But basically, we produced a model of the liabilities, put it onto the computer, had the Bloomberg asset prices coming in, and we could trade during the day. And basically, if you're running a dynamic program and you're comparing it with a competitor who's running options, their options are being rebalanced in real time. So why aren't you rebalancing your dynamic hedging in real time?
And part of it, yeah, that's a good question. a lot of the focus on this presentation was around like long-term investment guarantees, and so one thing is like it ends up being that even though we're monitoring the market continuously through the day, typical trading activity is like on hedging deltas around weekly on Roe and Vega. It's monthly because a lot of these products, the actual claim payments that might occur are 15 years away. In terms of just recalculating the liability Greeks on the fly, it's really a practical issue. Like a lot of our clients, they'll have 500,000 policies, and you've got to do a Monte Carlo simulation on each one. So it's not really practical to run it throughout the day. Now, what we do is, you can calculate cross Greeks and additional shocks overnight, so that you're covered for larger equity market movements.
Andrew?
Thanks very much. I wanted just a straightforward question. The question that surprises me is why the reinsurers are being so slow. There's an enormous demand, certainly throughout Asia, throughout the businesses I know, relatively primitive insurance companies, where the actuarial professional, my generation, has been absolutely hammering away to get guarantees out of the system. Because we know the guarantees are too high. We don't need MCEVs and Basel 2, 3, or 5 to tell us that the guarantees are too high and the bonuses are too high. Now, as we're hammering that out, we know that we need to enrich our unit-linked products with some sort of guarantee. Otherwise, we're dead. We're going to be beaten by the unit trust. So this sort of thing, the idea of enriching products and providing usable guarantees, I mean, there is a great difficulty. We've been giving them away. People don't know how much they're worth. But this movement is absolutely essential. Now, there are a number of dialogues going on where investment bankers come around and talk to actuaries, I'm afraid, like me and a few others. And it's actually quite a hard dialogue because, you know, there are language difficulties. Now, the reinsurers are our natural backup. They come and tell us about, you know, issues, complex issues in medicine. And that's not the issue now. It's complex issues in guarantees and economics. Now, do you know why it is that we do not see the leading reinsurers bringing us the straightforward products to enable, because the natural reinsurance position is not to talk to us about medicine, it's to talk to us about benefits. They are linked into our business. Investment bankers sadly aren't. It's very difficult. It's a major career risk to introduce an investment banker in a life insurance company because they don't smell right. The reinsurers do. Why aren't they providing us with the support that we need?
I can actually see a couple of reinsurers in the audience. Does anyone want to take that question, or should I leave it to the panel? No? Wade?
I'll start off, and you know, they can feel free to jump in and shoot me down if I say something incorrect. But you know, I guess the anecdote I've got to that, Andrew, is you know, I was recently at the Hong Kong conference, which was set up, I think, through the SOA to talk about equity-based guarantees. And there might have been, say, 300 people there, and I was astounded to see that about 80% were either reinsurers, investment banks, or consultants. So, you know, it was really interesting to me just to see that the Asian market really does seem, you know, off the back of that anyway, to be a hive of activity where companies are looking at some third-party approaches. And then I guess, I did see the odd breakfast I was sitting at, you know, reinsurers and investment banks sitting at the same table. So I think, you know, there's a lot of activity going on, and I think the same thing's true in Australia, that reinsurers are, you know, are starting to become a bit more prevalent in this type of product. Deep and Rajiv might want to comment, but I guess what happened in the US may have led to some of the fallout, where originally with a lot of the guarantees, going back into the early days, companies did actually reinsure them. The reinsurers then didn't risk manage them appropriately, so felt the brunt of the pain when the market corrected. The drying up of that reinsurance market overnight is essentially what led to the development of in-house dynamic hedging programs by insurance companies. And you know, thankfully, that actually, you know, stimulated the product design, and you started to see these more innovative products that actually start to address some of the real issues. And now, given that those hedging programs have withstood the test of time a little bit and you know, have gained in popularity and familiarity, now you're starting to see the risk transfer options and reinsurance market, you know, build up again. And I expect it to, to grow significantly as part of the solution for these types of products.
I think there was someone at the back. Anthony?
Thanks. Anthony Asher. I'm interested, there doesn't seem to be much comment about capital requirements. With the hedging strategy, you're saying you don't need capital because you instantaneously respond to any losses. And that raises one question about, well, that's all very well, but we've got to require, in every other capital requirement, we've got to assume that we can take an entire 12 months to respond. And maybe there's some, it may be worth some dialogue in thinking about this issue, is whether a one-minute response, instantaneous response, and a 12-month response, there should be somewhere in between. That brought me actually on to thinking about using risk-neutral probabilities. They don't seem to me to be appropriate for determining capital requirements, and also for determining, if you're wanting to determine some deadweight losses in terms of the loss of equity premium type story, one actually needs some real world calculations to determine it. I see the nod, so that's thank you.
Yeah, I want to take the first bit and then pass it to Deep, because I think the interesting answer to that question is firstly, the current state of Australian capital requirements, and secondly, what's happened in markets like the US, where these products are a bit more commonplace. I guess in the Australian market, when you're developing any hedging strategy for these types of products, capital is a key thing. Because you still have this environment where you're tested under very significant market shocks. You don't get any real credit for the fact of whether you can rebalance the hedging position. And, the argument there is to say, well, in an extreme market shocks, what happens if liquidity dries up and you can't rebalance? So the capital's, something that you need to hold. So, there are various strategies you can overlay on top of an economic position to essentially manage that capital, but it obviously comes at a cost, and that's something you need to test when you're going through product development. I'll pass it to Deep, and he can maybe talk a bit about what's happening in the US.
Sure, yeah. For these types of guarantees, the approach that they've taken in the US is quite a bit different than in Australia. In Australia, they're looking at the fair value and taking instantaneous shocks and looking at the change in the fair value. In the US and Canada, similar approach to what you're describing. They actually do a traditional stochastic cash flow projection. They run it over 1,000 real-world scenarios, not risk-neutral scenarios, and take the tail. And they define that as the worst-case outcome. And they look at over the life of the product, with the U.S., with the Australian approach, it's more instantaneous. So what's interesting is, in terms of looking at those hedging objectives that we described before, it sounds like with the Australian approach, if you're just doing economic hedging, it may not provide the most capital relief. You may actually want to add additional hedges for the large shocks that are embedded in the capital calculation. While from our experience in the U.S., it's the other way. Like if you'd actually do a little less hedging if you wanted to just manage your capital.
Just to add to that, Deep alluded to this. So the full reflection of the hedge strategy, the rebalancing or the existing asset that you're holding, that can be reflected in the capital calculation. So under the 1,000 scenarios or what have you, you'll actually reflect some essence of your hedge strategy in the projection.
Andrew Barker. Just had a question. You mentioned or referred to some of the assets being unhedged. So just wondering if you could give us some insight as to what would typically be unhedged, whether it's the over-under performance versus the benchmarks of the fund managers, or whether it's particular asset classes. I'm guessing direct property would be a tough one to hedge, for example. So just some insight into that.
So, I mean, the idea is to do a regression of your funds over your hedged indices. And so property and so forth will be mapped somewhat artificially to one of these indices. So another approach then is to say, well, it's unhedged. Let's define the hedged indices and the unhedged indices. And then when you do the market shocks in your attribution, you run them one at a time. What we find, though, is the allocation to precious metals and gold funds and so forth, in the overall, at least in the U.S. market, in the overall scheme, it's not attracting a lot of money. And so this unhedged component or this noise shows up as a kind of a balancing item in your attribution. Now, the key here is once that balancing item becomes larger as a percentage of account value over time, you start dissecting that. And so then you may see certain things like, I think I had transfer impact. So the actual asset allocation, the attribution of asset allocation then starts carving out part of the balancing item. But you're right. I mean, there's for the unhedged indices, it becomes really a company specific decision as to whether that's market noise, ignore it, or to do a full attribution on it.
I was just going to add, I guess, that it's an interesting thing in an Australian context because there is an increasing trend towards investment in alternative assets for which there may not be any real liquid index to hedge against. And to that extent, it's when you look at the contract on an individual basis and has maybe a high allocation to one of those asset classes, then it looks particularly bad. But as you aggregate all this business up for a fund manager's portfolio, then for the large ones anyway, they essentially look like the market. So, to that extent, there's an ability to take on some of that and include it. You've just got to be aware that the risk is that people start allocating, large quantities of their investment to those types of asset classes.
Chris, and then maybe one more and then we'll wrap up.
Chris Condon. Thanks, guys. Two questions that I think do have some sort of link, but they might not appear that at first pass. So in, for example, 1987, we saw the portfolio insurance taking on quite a big component of what turned out to be a feeding on effect, and various people have different views on this, but certainly contributed to the gapping. So the first question is, are we seeing either in these types of products and these types of programs for insurance companies, but maybe also in hedge funds and other types of investors, a similar growth in concentration of activity that might create this sort of gapping in the future? And here's the other sort of, I think, related question, but it might not sound like it at first pass. What is it about product design for these types of riders that mitigates that type of risk? For instance, and what is it that accelerates it, such as, for instance, ratchets and things like that?
I will get deep to comment anyway, just simply because I guess the US market does see a fair amount of money in this type of business. So, to the extent that they have seen the big market moves at the moment, then it'd be interesting just to see. I think it is a little bit the nature of the products themselves as well. When you start talking about the US being $1.5 trillion in terms of assets under management, it's not $1.5 trillion in very short term options. It's these are retirement savings contracts. They're generally long term income related benefits, and so as Deep was saying earlier, the trading frequency for those is a lot less frequent. It's once a week for things like market movements. It's less frequent for interest rates and volatilities. I guess the interesting thing in the US is the growth of what they call equity indexed annuities, which is a different animal altogether. And in there, the trading is a lot more frequent. So over the recent market crisis, you've seen trading sort of for those types of contracts 6 or 7 times a day. And I think potentially those types of books where and investment banks where they've got a lot of short term options are probably more exposed to that systemic type of risk.
As Wade was saying, the typical rebalance frequency on these types of guarantees is weekly. over the past few months, we've just seen that it's more frequent. So it's like every other day, but it's still not. For these shorter term products where you see that kind of risk, it's still not there for these. And if it was, you can always add some structured hedges or add options. A lot of our clients are just delta hedging, so they're buying linear like futures instruments.
Just to add to that, I have an article example here. I have a client with $130 billion of account value. They may have 5 trades a month, so that's how infrequently the trade activity happens. Regarding the second part of the question, or at least what I'm going to call the second question, I might have changed it, product design leading to some mitigation. So one thing that we're seeing in the U.S., WB for life at 5%, let's say. So instead of having it locked at the 5%, where you actually have to hedge that 5% annuitization, which may happen 10 to 15 years from now, we're seeing a floating rate design where, in fact, it's tied to some index. So the annuitization rate is tied to, at the time of annuitization, whatever interest rate index is at that time. So you can avoid having to have a leveraged interest rate position for the 10, 15 years of buildup. So.
I think it's probably all we've got time for now, so I'd ask you all to thank our presenters in the usual way.